The following program is paid for by CHI Mercy Health Mercy Medical Center. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Each weekday, News Radio 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now, Talking Health, presented by CHI Mercy Health. Now, here's Talking Health with Lisa Platt on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Afternoon, and in for Lisa Platt again, I'm Kyle Bailey. We take this time each week for now to focus on the public health aspect of the COVID-19 pandemic. Talk about what's going on in Douglas County, statewide, the nation, and beyond. And one guest today, been with us every week for the past several, County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer. Dr. Bob, thanks for being on again this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me again.
Well, as we have been for a few weeks now, we try to take this time to go in depth on COVID-19 and stick with the health aspects. Obviously, a lot of political aspects in the news today, but we'll save that for later. On the health side, talk about where we are, starting with the world view of the U.S., Oregon, and the county when it comes to COVID-19.
Well, starting from the world view, this is still a very, very active pandemic. We added about 600,000 cases over the last week. So that's a tremendous number of cases. And we're starting to see huge outbreaks in Brazil and Russia. Those are very worrisome because those are countries that don't have first world healthcare systems, and we're afraid these could really spread. The other place that we've seen a big outbreak is in India. Now, the numbers are still relatively low, especially compared to the population, but India is such a densely packed country that we are really afraid that cases could just explode in a place like India. In the U.S., cases have been fairly flat. I wish I could say they were really down, but they've been kind of flat over time. And some of the areas that had the highest concentration of cases in the New York, New Jersey area have slowed down a little bit. In the rest of the country, we're still seeing a bunch of cases, but I think the growth rate has slowed a little bit. In Oregon, we're still relatively low. We are the fifth lowest state in the country in terms of our caseload. And the number of new cases is down. Yesterday, we only had 12 new cases, which is the lowest number that we've had in a few months. We're back up today to 64, but we really in Oregon have done a good job at staying relatively low in our number of cases. And then when we move into Douglas County, we're still very low. We did have a new case over the weekend, which we'll talk a little bit more about later, but that was a relatively mild case, and 23 of the 25 have recovered. We still have a very sick person in the hospital, but other than that, Douglas County has been relatively unscathed.
What countries have had few issues dealing with the virus? Have there been anywhere this really hasn't been much of an issue?
Antarctica is the only place that doesn't have any cases, and North Korea says they don't have cases, but I believe Antarctica, but not North Korea. There are places in the world that have had cases, but have done pretty well. I mean, so China, with a population of 1 billion, although they were early on, they're still just at less than 100,000 cases. So they've done a good job of containing it. I think Taiwan has also done a remarkably good job of containing the virus.
But aren't some folks a little suspect of China's statistics?
Yes, as am I. So I am very skeptical of the things that they said. They might have two or three times many cases, but even at two or three times, that's still a very, very, very low rate.
For the areas that are having these newer spikes around the world, talk about what's going on in those places.
Well, for example, Russia now has the second most cases in the world following the U.S. And so they, with a relatively small population, had another almost 10,000 cases today. So that's a real worry. Russia early on denied that it had any problem at all. But I think now we're starting to see that they really do indeed have a problem. So that's a real worry because Russia's a very dispersed country that does have some low-level healthcare issues. And then Brazil's an issue. mean, Brazil could barely be more warm. So, you know, the thought that we might be able to avoid this because we got to warm, humid weather seems not to be the case. And they just had 13,000 cases today and almost 700 deaths. So, that, you know, that those are two really, really, really worrisome issues. And what's worrisome is that as we try to open up, we are going to have some international travel. And unless this virus is taken care of well throughout the world, we're really gonna struggle with reopening the world.
What are some of the new things that are being learned about the virus?
Well, there are a couple of new things I want to talk about. One is this pediatric inflammatory syndrome. That's a real, real worry. Early on, we realized that kids did not get very sick from the virus itself, although since the virus has now spread to many places in the world, we do realize that kids do get it, and they do sometimes get sick and do sometimes die, but at a much lower rate than older people. But what we've seen in the last few weeks is this pediatric multisystem inflammatory disease. These are kids that presumably had the virus a few weeks before, and then their body just makes this crazy reaction to the virus. So this is the time they're positive for antibodies. So presumably their body has already seen the virus and is making a response to it and goes totally overboard with high fever, a lot of inflammation, a rash, swollen glands, all kinds of issues. So we really, really worry about this. This new pediatric inflammatory system has had a couple of deaths and lots of kids have been sick enough that they wound up in the ICU. So that's something you can learn.
Now, is this something that's shown up more recently, or do you think it was occurring earlier and just hadn't been noticed?
Well, we think it's relatively uncommon. So we think you have to have, you know, it's maybe only one in 10,000. So in a place like China that maybe only had 80,000 cases, there only been eight cases, and it would have been hard to know. But once you start getting to the number of cases they had in northern Italy, the number of cases they've had in the UK, and the number of cases they've had in New York, they now start to say, well, this is really weird to see all of the cases of what looks like Kawasaki's disease at this time. Because we see Kawasaki's disease, but it comes in very small numbers, and these pediatric hospitals were seeing big numbers. So I think it might have always been there. We'll go back through the Chinese and the Korean data to see if it was there. But it very clearly is here now, seen in three different parts of the world and resulting in pediatric ICU admissions.
As this evolves, are there changes in sort of what we think the impacts of the virus can be?
Yeah, I think there are. I think one of the new things that's come out has been something we've learned from the aircraft carrier Teddy Roosevelt. So if you remember, this was an aircraft carrier that had a big outbreak, about over 1,000 cases of COVID on this aircraft carrier. What was interesting is that people were sick, but these are relatively young and healthy kids, and they only had one death. They were incredibly careful about following these sailors who were positive. They looked to be sure that they were asymptomatic for at least 2 weeks and had two negative tests. So 13 of their sailors met those criteria. They had the disease. They got better. They were asymptomatic for at least 2 weeks. Most of them were asymptomatic for 3 weeks. They had two negative nasal swabs. They went back to the ship, and then they got sick with it again. And so that would be really unusual for a disease that you could get it again within a month or two after getting it the first time. And that's a worry because it suggests that immunity won't help that much, and it makes our prospect for a vaccine a bit more grim.
Now, what about the aspect of sailors being in close quarters versus what folks have been trying to encourage regarding social distancing?
Right. So having been in the Navy for many years, there is no way to social distance on an aircraft carrier. So I would strongly recommend that if anybody gets a chance to go and visit an aircraft carrier, there's one in San Diego Harbor, it's absolutely obvious why things would spread and spread quickly in an area like that. So that's why we think it spread. But the interesting thing here was young, healthy people got the disease. They got, by every measure, got over it, and then they get it again. And they likely won't get sick because they're young and healthy. But what would happen now if seniors get it, get over it, and then get it again? That will really take a toll on our nursing.
And what about folks that have had it, especially older folks? I've heard some things about coming out of it being, in some cases, a very long process and some lung and breathing issues and things like that that are there for a very long time.
Yes, we have been shocked at how long this has lasted. I mean, most diseases you get over within 3 to 4 weeks, you're back to good. Many of these people have been really sick for a long time, even with breathing problems and needing to be on oxygen. One of the things that's been the most long-lasting has been this terrible diarrhea that people have had. The symptoms are long-lasting. Now, the thing that's amazing about this disease, there are also then people who are totally asymptomatic. So it makes no sense why in a similar population some people would get the typical disease, be sick for a week or two, other people would have no symptoms, and other people would be really quite ill for 2 months.
As people look forward, I hear the word treatment, I hear the word vaccine. Is it going to be either or?
I don't know which it's going to be. When people ask me how it's going to end, I tell them predictions are really hard, especially about the future. But we see 4 different ways that this might end. One would be an effective vaccine, and the good news today is that Moderna's phase 1 trial appeared to be successful. So phase 1 trial is you make a vaccine or a medicine, you try it on very few healthy people, in this case 8 healthy people. You look to be sure there's no bad side effects from it and that the body does react to it. In this case, their phase 1 trial showed that of the 8 people that were tested, they had no serious side effects and they did develop antibodies. However, going from that to larger trials, and does it actually prevent you from getting the disease? We don't know. So a vaccine could clearly be a way that we could get through this.
But
there's lots of issues with the vaccine.
Well, and in most cases, don't vaccines take longer to develop? Isn't there a bit of a danger with sort of rushing a vaccine?
Well, so vaccines are usually extensively tested, right? Since vaccines are there for prevention, they're usually very, very extensively tested. And that's why in the past, most vaccines take 5 or more years to develop. In this case, I think we're going to try and balance the dangers of going fast and the advantages of getting the vaccine sooner. But yeah, this is going to be a very, very quick vaccine if it gets there. The other way that this could end is that we could get a very effective treatment. Imagine if we came up with an antiviral drug that really worked. Now, remdesivir is out there, and it shows that antiviral drug can work a little bit, but it's not really that great. It doesn't change mortality at all. It does apparently decrease the length of hospitalization. But let's say we could get a antiviral drug out there that was 90 or 95% effective. That would really change things because it would change this disease from being something we really worry about and could clog the hospital to something where you have to take a medicine and you get over it. So that's a possibility. The third is we could come up with a preventive treatment, and the preventive treatments could be either a medicine. So there are people, for example, take a preventive medicine so they won't get HIV, called PrEP. There are people who can get a shot of immunoglobulin so they won't get a certain disease. So, for example, if you got exposed to hepatitis B, we could give you a shot of something called hepatitis B immune globulin, and that would almost certainly prevent you from getting the disease. So we might come up with something like that. Or we might come up with a monoclonal antibody. So monoclonal antibody is a specific laboratory-made antibody that would bind to the virus and basically make it inert. And so you can imagine if we came up with a monoclonal antibody and enough people were able to get this monoclonal antibody, especially high-risk people, we'd be able to transform this from something which is really devastating to something which is just annoying.
I know sometimes with different medications over time, folks look at side effects and after effects and things that happen when people have been taking something for a period of time that didn't initially appear that they would be an issue. What about the danger of getting a vaccine or treatment that seems to work now but causes issues that aren't seen until down the road?
Yeah, and that is a big concern, right? So any of the things that we do have effects and side effects. So, for example, when chloroquine came out, we were thinking, well, what's the harm in using that? But now we realize there's significant cardiac issues. So I think you really need to be concerned about effects and side effects. And many times when something comes out, you don't really notice the side effects until weeks or months later. So, for example, there was a vaccine about 20 years that came out for a disease called rotavirus. And the first kind of this vaccine did seem to work against rotavirus, but also caused a rare complication called intussusception. And once we learned that, we pulled the vaccine. In this case, you'd be given the vaccine so quickly that if there was a side effect that took a few months to figure out, it would be really, really difficult.
I got to take a break on Talking Health. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer with us. The program, of course, a podcast after 1 at 541radio.com. Back in 2 minutes, 421 at News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Again, in for Lisa Platt, I'm Kyle Bailey. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer with us as we look at the public health response to COVID-19 in Douglas County and beyond. A lot of different things to talk about today. We brought this up so many times, yet it seems to be evolving. There seems to be a lot of back and forth, a lot of debate. Again, still about the issue of what masks do and don't do, even some health officials on the national level not in agreement on it. Again, talk about what we know for sure and why there's so much different info on masks coming out, even from the government agencies.
Well, I will tell you, it is really confusing. If we were trying to confuse people, I don't think we could have done a better job. We weren't out there to confuse people, but I think the public health authorities in the country really have confused people. So let's start off what we do know. We do know that the high-quality medical masks that people wear do protect the healthcare workers against disease. So the highest quality of those masks are the N95 masks. They block 95% of the stuff around. And we think those are critical for people taking care of sick people. For example, sick people in the ICU where there's a lot of spraying and bagging and suctioning and whatever that goes on. So those kind of masks are really important, and I don't think there's been any lack of clarity about that. Where there has been lack of clarity is about the use of masks for people in the general population. So that's when I go out and go to the grocery store. It's when you would go out and go on your walk about the use of masks. And what we do know in this disease, and what is relatively different with this disease, is that this disease seems to be really quite contagious in the pre-symptomatic phase. So you get exposed to the disease and you come up with symptoms. There's five or six days, and they're usually between the time that you've been infected and the time you have symptoms. About a day or two before you show symptoms, you are the most contagious. So here you don't even know you're sick. And you're out and about, and you can make other people sick. And the masks are very good at preventing you from giving this to someone else. So we did a little video on our Mythbusters thing that you can look at. Florida International University did a much more elegant one than we did. And what you can show is that if you cough or sneeze when you wear a mask, those droplets stay very close to you, whereas if you don't have a mask on, it goes out. So we always say that the use of a mask in public is not necessarily to protect the person wearing the mask, it's to protect the others that they're around. So I wear a mask not to protect myself, but I wear it to protect the others that I'm around. And I think the best way of looking at this is the sign of respect. And the sign of respect is I care about you and I don't want to make you sick. So if I go out to the grocery store, I think about those people who are sitting there all day being around people and how many people they get exposed to. And by me wearing a mask, if it decreases their exposure, it's what I'm willing to do to do that.
Over the weekend, the governor put out guidance regarding masks, calling for more mask usage requirements in stores. Some of those, of course, began voluntarily by stores on their own, starting to see more of that with a number of the chains that are requiring employees to have masks and requiring that customers, in some cases, have masks as well. Obviously, sometimes that gets a bit of pushback. It did appear over the weekend. I was not in stores very much, but a couple of times, one Saturday, I think, and one on Sunday, One store I was in, they're required. The other store, they're not for customers. But it really looked to me like the number of people wearing masks had gone up quite a bit in just 1 week's time.
Well, I've been looking each week, and I think we're stuck at about 25 or 30%. Now, the stores have done a very good job in having the employees use masks, but I think for shoppers, we're still at 25 or 30%. But this is a huge, huge societal and personal change. I remember back when I wore a tie every day and how liberating it was not to use a tie. So if people said, no, you now have to wear a tie again, it took me a little while to get used to that. And so it's not surprising that it takes people a little while to get back to, a little while into using masks.
Well, and it just seems so counterintuitive, where it seems like we've said before, like it's something out of a bad science fiction movie.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think if you try to come up with a deadly virus or a dastardly virus, this would be it. And it would be, you know, if you had one that was very deadly like SARS or Ebola, you can rapidly get around that and control it. And that's why there have not been big outbreaks of Ebola outside of Africa. And that's why SARS was able to get done. But this one is tricky in that it's got all of those asymptomatic people who feel fine and go around, and especially those pre-symptomatic people who feel fine and they go to choir practice or they go to a cocktail party or they go to a funeral and then infect all of these other people there. The other thing about this disease is that if it was uniformly fatal, it would blow through a community and then there'd be nobody left to infect. This one, we think that at least 95% of the people that it infected continue to live and they continue to go on and be able to transmit. And then the last part about this, which will be really unusual, would be if you can get it again. So, you know, most bad diseases, smallpox, measles, hepatitis A, when you get those diseases, you can get pretty sick, but you will never get them again. In this one, if the data from that Teddy Roosevelt is clear that you can get this within a few weeks or months after getting it the first time, this is truly a dastardly virus.
What about the aspect I'm hearing from some folks who say there are medical conditions or even issues with breathing where a mask for the wearer causes more problems?
Well, so there are two issues with the mask and how it could cause troubles. One is, if you're using a mask to protect yourself and then you do a lot of touching of your face, that's bad because that's how we think people get it. So sometimes the thing directly goes in your mouth or nose or directly goes in your eyes. But we think the other way to do it is you get it on some other surface. You touch it with your hands. And then if you touch your mouth or your hands, you basically self-inoculate. So masks can be negative in that way. The other way is that the mask, especially as you get to higher and higher quality masks, they filter more and more of air, so it gets harder and harder to breathe. And so some people with underlying respiratory issues may find it hard to use masks, and that's okay. So if there's some person who is sickly, so sickly that the mask makes it hard for them to breathe, I can take that. But then they should also stay home. So if you're that sickly that you can't breathe through a mask, you probably are in a high-risk group and you should be at home anyway.
Do you think the wearing of masks is going to outlast the COVID-19 situation?
It may well. So this may become a new fashion statement. I'm using a balaclava, and it just is part of my daily routine. Just put it on in the morning when I get up, just so like wearing socks and underwear. It's just part of my daily routine. So it may become part of the daily routine. It's a relatively easy one to do. And if this is what I need to do to not make you ill, then it's worth it.
Now, we've talked about wearing masks in places where social distancing is harder, and stores, grocery stores in particular, places like that. What if you are in an indoor workplace where folks have spread out and there's plenty of room? Should you consider wearing one inside in your office?
So there's all kinds of different recommendations. I think the best recommendation I heard is that when you're not sure about social distancing, you should wear a mask. When you can be sure of social distancing, like I'm sitting now in my office with the door closed, I can take the mask down. But if I was in a group, if I was walking to the conference room, if I was going to get a cup of coffee, I should definitely put my mask on.
Any other thoughts that people ought to consider when it comes to masks, especially for the folks that have just, it just rubs them the wrong way?
So some of it rubs you the wrong way, then don't do it. I mean, the story on masks is that we don't have mask police. I don't think anyone's going to stop you if you don't wear a mask. But I think it's a sign of disrespect. I think it's a sign that my discomfort with the mask is more important than the possibility that I would infect you. So personally, I will wear a mask. If other people don't want to wear a mask, I will never stop somebody on the road and tell them to wear a mask.
County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer. More when we come back. Other things to talk about. 4:33, a 3-minute break. Talking Health, of course, a podcast after 5 at 541radio.com. Listen back if you missed portions or share it with others as well. News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Hi there, and for Lisa Platt, Kyle Bailey, Talking Health every week, looking at the public health impact and aspect of the COVID-19 pandemic. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer with us again today. Phase 1 reopening began in 31 counties in Oregon, including Douglas County on Friday. How does it seem to be going so far by your observation?
Well, it seems to be going pretty well. You know, this is still pretty early. What I noticed is that some of the restaurants opened up, but there are many restaurants that still remain closed or have very little seating. I've also noticed that some of the restaurants that are open and do have seating are pretty empty. So I think it's going to take a little while for people to get socially ready to go back and to mix again. But I think generally people have done a great job. I have been so impressed by the people in Douglas County that they've generally followed recommendations. I understand there's some people who are not interested in following recommendations. That's okay. What we're really looking for is the mainstream people who are following that. And for those few outliers, we'll just call them outliers.
Well, as from the business side of this, as we talked about in a different interview earlier today, one of the things I was told too last week ahead of the governor's announcement on Thursday was that for some of the business community, depending on especially the independent businesses, if you're not part of a chain, you don't have a lot of things in place, folks had taken big economic hits. They weren't going to go out, get supplies, for instance, in the case of restaurants, go out and purchase food wholesale, get the delivery trucks headed to their location again until they knew for sure. And it was going to take some time to build back up, and a lot of folks are starting with more limited menus. Some restaurants reopened today, waited through the weekend, made sure they had everything set. I know there's others that are opening later this week, and even in the case of some big chains where they're sort of falling under corporate guidance as regions in the U.S. gradually reopen. There was one locally that I believe they were not going to be open back up to Memorial Day weekend just because of the work that would be needed in a large place as well. And as many have said, while some of the places may open, folks, especially depending on their viewpoint or their health concerns, are probably going to be coming back in slowly, or in the case of restaurants, still doing takeout until they feel everything is okay. One person I talked to said, you know, I want to make sure we do phase one right. I don't want to go back to where we were, a week ago just because things don't go right.
That's exactly right. I think this is the classic chicken and egg conundrum. So airlines don't want to put on flights if nobody's going to fly, but nobody will fly if there are no flights. Certainly nobody's going to go to restaurants if there's no food, but restaurants don't want to order food unless they know there are people there. And so I think this is going to be a slow feel it out kind of deal. And I think that's the right way to do it, actually. I think a wild reopening doesn't make a lot of sense, but I think a slow measured approach is exactly the way we should go. And so I've been very proud of the business owners and everybody else in Douglas County.
What about health officials like Oregon Health Authority? What kinds of things are they watching for, not just in Douglas County, but the other 30 counties that are in phase one reopening?
Well, so, you know, I'm pretty much a COVID nerd here. And believe it or not, there's probably another 50 of us in the state who are looking at lots of things. But the things we're looking at are things like number of new cases. And as I said, the number of new cases is relatively low. other things that we're looking at is the number of hospitalizations, because the number of cases could certainly go up if you just did better testing. So imagine that if you really increased your testing and found every case, your number of cases would go up, but your number of severe cases and hospitalizations would stay the same or go down. And I think through Oregon, we're especially looking at hospitalizations. And the number of hospitalizations in Oregon really has gone down, greatly.
And I know that was one concern. Somebody said, well, if testing ramps up further, they're going to find more folks. And then are we going to be, quote unquote, penalized for that?
No, you won't get penalized, because the thing that we're really looking at is test positivity rate. So if you did three times as many tests and found one and a half times as many cases, kind of what we've done in Douglas County, you actually get credit for that. So we understand that. We look at the numbers all the time. We understand that.
What about for residents, we go back into phase one, social distancing. Talk about maintaining that for the long term.
So social distancing, I think, is going to be one of the new normals. So I don't think I need to share germs with other people. And just like after 9/11, we changed things. We used to just be able to run right onto the airplane. And then we got to the point where we went through security and put our shoes on the belt and did that. And that seems like a tremendous inconvenience. But you know what? After a while, it didn't really dissuade anybody from flying. And so a lot of people flew. So I think now if we do more social distancing, that'll be perfectly fine. I don't need to share germs with most people. I'm perfectly happy to share germs with my family. But other than that, I'll be perfectly fine if we increase our standards of separation.
It's interesting, the parallels between 9/11, the accessibility to different locations, even the record keeping or the background checking, for instance, that's now in place to get into places like a tourist tour of the White House, that prior to 9/11, you could just stand in line and get a ticket, and literally anybody could get in for the limited area that you're able to look around. So that could indeed be one of those places where we see a long-term change. And when you look at the record keeping aspect of things, one of the things that seems to be getting more controversial that perhaps you could address is the area of contact tracing. A lot of folks have trouble saying that. What are contact tracers tasked with? What are they doing? What are they not doing?
So contact tracers are the people who, once we find a case, find other people that that person may have been in contact with and notify them so that if they need to be isolated or quarantined, they could do that. In addition, our contact tracers follow people who are in isolation and then help them out with the stuff that they need to get done. So we've had a few people in isolation in the last month, and they, for example, need us to bring them food. Many people don't have 2 weeks of food on hand, so we've needed to bring them food or medications. I checked today about doing laundry for some of the people who are in isolation or in quarantine. So those are the kinds of things that the contact tracers will do. Now, around the world, there have been different strategies. So, for example, in Israel, the Mossad tracks everybody by using video cameras and cell phones and knows where everybody has been. And so for somebody who's positive that they've crossed paths with somebody else, that somebody else gets a text message saying, on this day at this place, you are around somebody who subsequently tested positive. Korea did this using facial recognition, lots of cameras, credit card receipts, and phone tracking, so they were able to figure out where people went. I think that's probably a step too far in the U.S. I think if public health said, Kyle, I know every place you went in this last weekend and who you were around, people would not respond to that kindly. So I think in the U.S., it's going to be a little bit harder, because I think we do respect personal space and freedom a bit more.
Yeah, and that's one of those things where some folks look at this and say it's overarching a bit. One thing that's interesting, though, is the reality, and I saw this with another situation earlier today, is that retail establishments or big offices, big companies, routinely now have security video because they have things that are worth a lot of money. They want to make sure they don't have employee theft or customer theft or things like that. And you could oftentimes, I think especially on the criminal side, forget that if you are out doing a criminal act, it's quite likely that somebody's capturing it on video, even though they weren't watching for you. They were just wanting to keep their own facility safe.
Yeah, and so I think there is a lot more cameras around now than before, but I don't think we have nearly as many cameras as other countries that have per capita maybe 10 or 20 times as many cameras. And I think for the most part, the footage on those cameras is being locally held by the business person, and we're not using facial recognition. So it's a whole different world, I think, in Korea and Israel, where they do have lots of cameras and lots of facial recognition.
Very interesting. Are you hearing it from the public health side as being all that controversial, or is that more in the public arena where folks have a tendency to push back against some of the contact tracing?
So for public health, we talk about public health things. We do not. We talk about public health things. We don't talk about other political things. We do recognize that that would be a good strategy, but that's not something we're going to push if it's otherwise politically not acceptable.
Well, a lot of things to deal with when you look at a pandemic situation like this. And as you talked about before, this for pretty much anybody is new ground, although we can look back at 1918 and other situations like that and glean some lessons from some of those situations.
I think we will. So I think the best analogy actually that people can remember is 9/11 and some of the changes that needed to be made. But I think after 1918, there were other changes that were made in hospitals. There are changes that were made in doctor training and infection control. And I think we'll see some of the things like that. So, for example, there's been a big shortage of surgical masks and N95 masks. I think in the future, it'll be not unlikely that people who work in the ICUs will have some of those really high-tech hoods like the ones we use at our testing site. And just when you get hired in the ICU, you'll have one of those hoods. And then any time that you have a sick patient, you just put one of those hoods on. So rather than be an extraordinary thing, it'll be part of the new normal. And that's what I hope people do, is think of things as the new normal rather than, oh, this is terrible or awful. Actually, if every nurse in the ICU had their own PAPR, that would be a good thing. If we did more healthcare by telehealth, that would be a good thing. If people who are sick stayed home, that would be a good thing. So I'm seeing the real positive side of this. I know there's so much negative, but I can certainly see the positive side.
I was thinking yesterday and today, of course, today, the 40th anniversary of the eruption of Mount St. Helens in Washington State. I happen to live in Portland when that took place, so I had a clear view of things and remember a whole bunch of details about that probably aren't that interesting to a lot of people that weren't around it. But one of the things about that I'd actually forgotten until I was reading articles yesterday and this morning was about the fact that when the ash was raining down in eastern Washington and into Idaho as it did on May 18th and then later in the Portland area, that people were indeed wearing masks because there were health implications about getting it, and you didn't want to get sick from that. And you think about, oh, we've never worn masks before. Well, at that time, that was something where that needed to be done for a period of time, especially for a lot of folks. And folks wanted to protect themselves in that case, and so they were more willing to do it.
Exactly right. So I think people will do what needs to be done, and I think we in public health have the responsibility to communicate clearly why people should be wearing masks.
All right, going to take a break. More when we come back. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer, Kyle Bailey for Lisa Platt. It's Talking Health. Back in a couple of minutes. 4:49 at News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240, KQEN.
Afternoon to you on your drive home. Thanks for making Talking Health part of your commute. Kyle Bailey in for Lisa Platt, the afternoon report coming at 5 with Douglas County's news team. Our final segment, County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer with us this afternoon, looking at a lot of the aspects of the public health response to COVID-19. And now we have, we have back and forth weather. Today's kind of cloudy. It's been drizzly. There's some more rain ahead later in the week and for the long weekend for many. Looks like it's going to be dry for a few days and temperatures in the low to mid 70s. What about exercise? You've mentioned this before, but there still seems to be maybe confusion if people hear this on the national framework, because there are places where the limitations are more so to stay at home, period. What should people be doing and what should they avoid when it comes to trying to get some exercise and keep their physical health in good shape?
Well, Oregon is a little different because Oregon never said stay inside and said stay home, but go out to exercise. So I think we recognized early on that going out to exercise was an important thing, and we would strongly recommend that. So go for a walk. I understand you made a long walk this weekend. Going for a bike ride are great things to do. A recent study came out from China where they looked at a lot, 7,000 outbreaks, where they tried to pin down where people got it from, and only one of those was thought that they got it outside. The other 7,000 were inside. So the risk of outdoor activities is very, very, very low. And so I would encourage people to get out, walk, bike. Now, the one time where there was, it was two people having an animated discussion just a few feet away. And so I'd avoid animated discussions with neighbors from just a few feet away. But otherwise, going out, going on a bike ride, going for a walk, going for a run, they're perfectly great things to do.
I know when I was out walking on Saturday, I was out for probably 3.5 hours, something like that, and did not encounter a single person along my route except when I dropped down into our neighborhood and was contemplating whether to continue or not because I was being threatened with the weather, which at that point I managed to get by fairly unscathed, but that was during the time of the day when we had all that wind there for a while. And talked to one of the neighbors from while I stood in the middle of the street and they were on their porch. And my wife looked out and talked to me, talked to her a little closer, of course. But one of the things about that for folks, I think during this time, is with all the stress and all the deep, dark aspects of COVID-19, to get away, totally away. In my case, I do it without my phone, to go out and do that and have no contact with anybody or not be able to be found essentially for a few hours is sometimes very refreshing.
And it is. So we understand that public health also deals with behavioral health. And we know that people inside start to sometimes have troubles with anxiety and depression. And we do know that mild exercise like walking, riding your bike, is one of the greatest antidotes to anxiety and depression. So we really, 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 truly want people to go out.
A lot of folks, of course, are not used to walking. I think some people have taken up walking during this situation because some of the things they've done for exercise are not there, and that includes the framework coming down from the state that impacts the local facilities as well when it comes to things like contact sports.
Right. So contact sports are a little bit more complicated because with contact sports, you are in close animated contact with somebody else. So you could imagine if probably the highest risk would be wrestling, where you would be very close to each other, breathing and spitting and whatever on each other. Other contact sports I think we should avoid for now. There's plenty of sports out there that you can do with no contact, including tennis and pickleball and horseshoes and all those kinds of things that we can do that most of us enjoy. There are many of us at this age who are doing a lot of contact sports, I hope.
Well, and of course, in some cases, at different levels of the government, the recreational organizations, some of those places have gotten some of those locations closed just because of state guidance for operating recreation facilities. Because while one person might, for instance, play tennis and do that well, not everybody would probably do that, especially interactions in between matches and things like that. So that's something to look at as well. But of course, we've certainly got city and county parks all around the county that are great to walk around in, take the family out, take the dog out, etc.
Right. So going outside, we think, is perfectly great. And I try to model the very best of behavior. So I go out all the time and go for nice walks. I'd like to get back to the gym, but the Y is not opening for another few weeks, probably. So I really, truly want people to get out there and exercise And, you know, again, with family members, if you have contact with them inside, you can have contact with them outside. So my wife and I will sometimes go for a walk, which is perfectly fine. And then when I see somebody on the road walking towards me, I move 6 feet into the road, let them pass. And I think this is a perfectly, perfectly good thing to do.
About a minute left on Talking Health for today. Anything else that you want to focus on that people should remember during this time of COVID-19?
Yes. One is we will get through this. The second thing is that wearing a mask is a sign of great respect. The third is going outside and enjoying yourself is a good thing. And the fourth is there's a lot of things you can do which are nice things that you don't have to be in person. So calling an older relative, doing a nice thing for somebody else, those are all really important things at this time.
Now, of course, the Douglas Public Health Network has the COVID-19 hotline open as well. You're doing periodic Facebook Live events on the Douglas Public Health Network Facebook page. When's the next one of those?
At 6 o'clock tonight. So join us at 6 o'clock tonight, and we'll get people on the air to get questions, and we'll answer them. Probably many of the same questions we answer now. Our hotline is open 8 to 5 each day. And we're doing a drive-through tomorrow.
County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhoff for wrapping up Talking Health. Thanks for being on with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me.
4:59 at News Radio 1240 KQEN.
The preceding program was paid for by CHI Mercy Health Mercy Medical Center. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.